Does bariatric surgery improve heart attacks and strokes?
Are beta blockers safe in pregnancy?
Should you be consuming more PUFAs?
And you may be surprised what you find in your dietary supplements.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on October 19th, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, since you picked the one that was relative to beta blockers in pregnancy, that's in Annals of Internal Medicine, I think we should start with that one.
So the first question you might ask is, well, why would a woman potentially be taking a beta blocker during pregnancy to begin with? A woman may be on it and become pregnant. And secondly, is chronic hypertension is a major issue that is present in almost 1% of women that are pregnant in the United States. And that's a result of the fact that we've got increasing incidence of obesity, which is associated with hypertension, and also because the maternal age is increasing as well. And although this is one of the three antihypertensive medications recommended to use in pregnant women, there were some concerns based upon some animal studies that it could contribute to congenital malformations in the children. And so this study sought to address that. And they did that by looking at health agencies in five Nordic countries and in the United States, and that is a Medicaid database. They surveyed almost 20,000 women who were pregnant and had hypertension. Between about 10 and 20% were on a beta blocker. Then they compared them to the women that had hypertension and weren't on a beta blocker. And why is it important? Well, because just the presence of hypertension alone increases the risk of congenital malformation. So that's got to be your comparison group. They did not find an increased major risk of either major malformations, cardiac malformations, cleft lip, palate, or CNS malformations.
I'm wondering about the relationship between pre-existing hypertension and preeclampsia in pregnant women.
Well, in fact, you've highlighted a major issue. And for that reason, women that have these conditions should talk to their obstetrician about whether they should be on a low-dose aspirin, because we know that that's beneficial in these individuals.
But in general, you would say that this is pretty reassuring evidence that this is all going to be okay.
Yes. In other words, if there is an increased risk, it's very minor compared to the benefits associated with controlling hypertension.
Since we're talking about things that are beneficial, why don't we move to the Journal of the American Medical Association, taking a look at bariatric surgery and its benefit in macrovascular disease, heart attacks, strokes, angina, or the need for CABG, coronary artery bypass grafting. They took a look at folks who had diabetes, aged 19 to 79 years, who underwent bariatric surgery from 2005 to 2011. The majority of these folks had Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. There were 17% sleeve gastrectomy and 7% adjustable gastric banding procedures that were part of this group. They compared these to a very large group of folks, 1,400, almost 15,000 control patients on the type of surgery, their sex, their body mass index, hemoglobin A1C, and other measures. And they took a look over the long haul at, okay, what happened? I thought it was really revelatory that out of this combined over 20,000 surgical and non-surgical patients, at the end of the study period, there were only 106 macrovascular events in the surgical patients and 596 events in the matched control patients. So just like we always see with these giant studies with huge ends at the beginning, the actual number of incidents turns out to be relatively low. When they took a look at that more carefully, they saw that the bariatric surgery was associated with reduction in somebody's risk of having one of these outcomes.
In this relatively short period of follow-up, a median of about 5 years, you're right, about 4% of the individuals in the non-surgical group with diabetes had a macrovascular event. But here's the thing that's most remarkable to me, is we've directed a lot of attention in diabetes care to lowering hemoglobin A1C to try to prevent macrovascular events. And we've really not been very successful. This suggests that as opposed to pharmacologic therapy, that the bariatric surgery can decrease macrovascular events and do so in a statistically significant manner. Now, it's an observational study, so it's hard to give causal inference because you're comparing two different groups, but it's really suggestive and consistent with other studies that have shown the same thing.
It's very fascinating to me that frequently what happens when folks have bariatric surgery is they actually even sometimes come off of the operating table with a resolution or improvement of their type 2 diabetes.
Elizabeth, I have to say, I'm one of the slower adopters on this. Obviously, you and I want to prevent obesity when we can, but for people that are morbidly obese, the benefits of bariatric surgery in terms of lowering cardiovascular risk and now preventing macrovascular risk in diabetic patients is pretty compelling.
Very compelling. Let's turn to yours then in JAMA Open. This is a look at all those people who like to take supplements, and I actually have to include myself as one of those. Turns out that sometimes there are things in there that we really do not want to be taking.
So, Elizabeth, you're among the more than 50% of adults in the U.S. who consume dietary supplements. You know, this is a $35 billion industry. The thing about these dietary supplements that people may not realize is they're not subject to the pre-market safety and effectiveness testing that's required by the FDA for pharmaceutical drugs. So this is a very interesting study that looked over a 9-year period at the FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research in a particular area called the Tainted Products Marketed as Dietary Supplement Database. These are dietary supplements that were identified by the FDA as being tainted with unapproved pharmaceutical ingredients, and they identified 776 adulterated dietary supplements from over 140 different companies. They centered around three major types of supplements. 45% of them were for sexual enhancement, about 41% were dietary weight loss supplements, and about 12% were muscle building supplements. And in these supplements, they identified adulterants such as sildenafil, which is Viagra, fluoxetine, an antidepressant, medications that have been withdrawn such as sibutramine or phenylphthalein, which is a laxative, and unapproved drugs such as designer steroids. About 20% of these adulterated supplements contain two or more drugs that weren't approved.
How about data on where these things came from? Was there any differential there with regard to domestic versus international manufacture?
No, Elizabeth, you bring up a good point because there have been concerns about some of the overseas manufacturers having tainted drugs. In particular, valsartan has been taken off the market because many Chinese distributors have tainted it with a carcinogenic drug. But this particular study did not identify the pharmaceutical companies.
All right. So what should people do in your estimation?
We need to have really more stringent criteria. In fact, what you'd like is before they even went on the market is to have approval. They're examined. We need to give the FDA some teeth so they can get these things off the market. And we need to get Congress to reform what's called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994 to require firms to register these supplements with the FDA before they go to market.
We would also say, I guess, caveat emptor.
Yes.
Let us turn then, while we're talking about supplements, because we reported recently a manufacturer who sent out a press release saying, gosh, we have fractionated these fatty acids from fish oil, and we think we've got a winner here in terms of heart disease. We're waiting for the data on that study. So this one in the British Medical Journal took a look at a big study called the Cardiovascular Health Study. 2,600 plus adults enrolled in this study who were successfully aging, that is, they were healthy in 1992, 1993 at the time of their recruitment. They took a look really carefully at circulating fatty acids that were in their blood. They used gas chromatography to do that at three different points in the study, and they looked at total fatty acids, and they included alpha-linoleic acid, that's from plants, eicosapentaenoic acid, docosapentaenoic acid, and docosahexaenoic acid from seafood. They defined healthy aging as survival without chronic diseases, which I applaud them for being able to find this population of folks after age 65. What they basically found was that in older adults, a higher cumulative level of serially measured circulating N3 PUFAs, those are the things from seafood, were associated with a higher likelihood of healthy aging. So, should we be eating these things? They do recommend increased dietary consumption of them.
These PUFA, or polyunsaturated fatty acids, have been shown in many studies to be healthy. The value of this particular study is they actually measured these things in the bloodstream. Individuals that had the highest incidence of these seafood PUFAs had healthier aging. They said a 25% healthier aging. So it's not direct evidence, but it's suggestive and consistent with other data showing that seafood, particularly those that are high in unsaturated fatty acids, can be healthy long term.
And it remains to be seen whether extracting the ostensible healthy parts of those and giving them as supplements, including these high dose supplements, is going to be powerful.
Because Elizabeth, to date, we don't have studies suggesting that the supplements are as good or better than the seafood. So I would say eating seafood, definitely recommended. Taking supplements, really don't have good data for that at this particular time.
On that note, talk about that one this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.